If you love America, you... If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
There's no time to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute that you save. Legal tender's never gonna change the number on your days. The highest cost of living's dying, that's one everybody pays. So have it spent before you get the bill. There's no time to kill. If we'd known 10 years ago today would be 10 years from now, would we spend tomorrow's yesterday and make it last somehow? Would be the tears in someone else's game and never learn to play.
Welcome to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Radio. This is Dave Vance, your host for tonight's show. This program is sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council. Visit our website at www.tn4action.com. Our number here is 718-305-7176. Once again, this is Inside Tennessee Radio on Conservative Nation Radio. Before we get started, some thank yous are in order. I'd like to thank Bing Fishers, who is here today on his birthday, for all the show.
Hey, no problem, man. I like being here, Dave.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, no problem. And I enjoy it.
I really appreciate you being here on your birthday. I know it was kind of short notice, but you're a big help. Bing and Michael B. Smith have a 3-5 show on Sunday, Soldiers of Patriotism, and they do a really good job. Matter of fact, I think yesterday they had Michael Patrick Leahy from Breitbart. That was a great interview. I'd like to also thank Michael Smith for his help and Duke Brooks, the program manager, who spent a lot of time on the phone with me the last few days trying to get this ready, and Teresa Bruski, as well as all the different crew of hosts. I appreciate their help. As I mentioned, this program is sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council, a newly formed organization dedicated to restoring our Constitution and the Judeo-Christian values our nation was founded on. However, we don't believe that D.C. is salvageable through the normal process of elections and parties or pressure from organizations with similar goals as ours. We believe that the states are key to forcing the federal government to listen, and since Tennessee is the only state we can impact, that is our focus. We intend to force our state to stand up by educating our citizens on the issues from a constitutional perspective. Only if and when the citizens of Tennessee demand that their state officials stand up to the federal government will we see any real progress in reducing the size and scope of the government. For those of you living in other states that are tuned in, I hope that you will keep in mind that many of the issues we are facing in Tennessee are the same issues you are facing in yours as well. All of our states face the possible expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare. All of our states are dealing with the Islamist infiltration, often with the help of our respective state governments. The flood of illegals that the feds are responsible for, and too many states abet or refuse to deter, and all of us deal with the scourge of abortion that Roe v. Wade has caused. So while some issues may be specific to Tennessee, many will have relevance for every state, and we hope that you will tune in as well. While we will talk about a variety of topics on this show, with so many issues to deal with and limited resources, the Tennessee Action Council decided to focus on one specific objective in 2014. We elected to support the passage of Amendment 1 to the Tennessee Constitution, which would make the Constitution neutral on the issue of abortion. In 2000, the Tennessee Supreme Court found the state constitution protected abortion and would do so even if Roe v. Wade were overturned. Due to this decision, Tennessee has become an abortion destination as others from neighboring states come to Tennessee for easy access to abortion. We intend to support Amendment 1 by educating the public and working in coordination with other pro-life organizations to make sure this amendment passes. Fundraising for the needed material and media expenses will be a large part of our effort. You can donate on our website at www.tn4action.com. here in just a few minutes, we're going to, our first guest is David Fowler, and there's nobody in the state that knows more about this issue and has been involved with it longer. So he'll be with us here in just a few minutes. We're going to go to a quick news break. Once again, this is Inside Tennessee. I'm your host, Dave Vance, for tonight, and this is Conservative Talk Nation Radio. Thank you.
For Talk Radio News Service, I'm Jeff Holtzman. 13 U.S. mortgage lenders have provided $3.4 billion to borrowers who suffered financial injury because of errors in foreclosures in 2009 and 2010. That, according to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Is it time for charity donors to rethink how they determine which groups they give to? Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance President Art Taylor thinks so. Taylor tells TRNS that it's wrong for potential donors to choose charities simply because they boast of low overhead rates.
If you're just relying on that number, you're going to miss out on a whole host of organizations that could have high financial ratios but have other things that are really going wrong with them.
Taylor says charities with low overhead often fall short when it comes to staff quality and the ability to manage their donation systems. And the Environmental Protection Agency is considering upping the ethanol requirement in gasoline this summer, a move that threatens to ignite a new fuel war. Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service, Washington.
And welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Radio. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The call-in number is 718-305-7176. We have a caller on the line. Looks like this is Kurt. How we doing, Kurt?
Yeah, it's me, Dave. You surprised me there. Unless you got some dead air you need filled up, leave me parked on the side there, brother. As I know, your guys, guests that you've got lined up tonight are the top guys on these subjects that they're going to be talking about. So I'm just here. I'm along for the ride. Okay.
Yeah. Well, as far as guests go, I appreciate it, Kurt. As far as guests go, yeah, we've done pretty well for the first night in terms of guests. We've got David Fowler, ex-state senator. He's the head of Family Action Council of Tennessee. He's going to talk to us about Amendment 1, the history on it, and what we're going to try to accomplish, give us more insight than what I can on what we'll actually do and how this came about. And then we're going to have Bill Warner on from Political Islam. He's an author, professor, and most people from Tennessee are familiar with that name. Many of us probably listen who have attended one of his seminars. So hopefully he'll be on with us in a second hour.
Okay, good.
Kurt, you were at the Manchester event, correct?
Yes, I was. Yes.
Why don't you give me just curious to hear what your take was on that.
Well, okay. Excuse me. Of course, I did not get inside the building where the attorney, U.S. attorney, and the FBI agent and the representatives of AMAC were speaking. All I got of that was secondhand reports. However, some people did a good job of feeding us information on the outside. Tom Moore Jr. kind of jumped up there and acted as an impromptu master of ceremonies on the outside, and we had, between 200 or 300 people outside. And according to the authorities over there, the police, they were set up for 500 seats inside. They filled the seats, and then they opened the doors again later and let a bunch of people go in and stand around the perimeter of the building, which probably accounted for another 200 people at least. So there was 1,000 or more people there, and only about 15 of them were quote-unquote Muslims, and someone guesstimated about 25 supporters, which that included some federal people, et cetera, et cetera. My take on this was that, the people of Tennessee did themselves proud that night. You got a lot of flack from some of the media, no matter what we do, they're going to call us rowdy, rednecks, racist. You say good morning and you're a racist to these people. But there was nothing that anyone did outside or inside the building, as far as I know, that could be, nobody arrested, I'm going to put it that way. You know, the police didn't report any problems. What it boils down to is those people that put that event on, just they didn't like what happened, because these were Tennesseans, these were American citizens standing up for their First Amendment rights. And I had a thought cross my mind today, and I'm going to toss this out. We may or may not get some mileage out of this, but the initials of that group that was heavily involved with that is AMAC, American Muslim Advisory Council. Now, here's my question. The first two words of that, American Muslim. A message came out to us from the speakers from the inside that night that they had said, quote, "We cannot live under the American Constitution."
Yeah.
We cannot do that.
Yeah.
Well, it's always been my opinion and that to be an American, you live under the Constitution.
I'm gonna hold off on you for right now, and we are gonna come back to the subject with our second hour. But
David Fowler
just popped up, and I want to get him on here if we can.
Okay, let David talk by all means.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
David, you there?
Yes. Hey, David, how are you?
Doing fine so far, I guess. I appreciate you being on the show.
I'm glad to be on. Somebody said that you need to call in to the new Walter Cronkite that's for real and conservative.
Yeah, right.
So you've built a fine reputation already.
well, thanks. But anyway, hey, little background. I mean, you were a state senator for, 10 or 12 years, and you've been out for a few years now.
Right.
You're the head of Family Action Council Tennessee, and really been involved with this fight since it started back in 2000. So why don't you just give us a little synopsis from your time back in the Senate when this issue first came up?
Well, thank you, David. Yes, the Supreme Court in the year 2000, in the fall of 2000, ruled that there was a fundamental right to abortion in our state constitution. Just for a little inside information for your listeners, that opinion was released on a Friday. That was the Friday before a huge UT football game. And I can't remember if it was Alabama or Florida, but whatever it is, your listeners that follow Tennessee football knows that everybody in the state is listening on the radio. Nobody's reading the Saturday morning paper. And the majority judges, it was a 4-1 opinion, had pressed the dissenting judge to make sure that they had the opinion in time to release it on that Friday afternoon. And I can't help but believe that some of that was an effort to dampen the news that it would be, because by Friday afternoon, so many newspapers, it's pretty much lined up what their stories are going to be, and they've written their paper for Saturday. And oftentimes a lot of it for Sunday has been booked out, and it would be old news by Monday. So anyway, that's just a little interesting tidbit that your listeners would get here. So I found out about the opinion and immediately called Tennessee Right to Life. Our organization didn't exist at the time, and said, hey, I'm going to do something to fix the Constitution. And we drafted what became known as Senate Joint Resolution 127, which is going to be on the ballot. We'll talk more about that as Amendment Number 1. And I began the effort then in the Senate to try to pass the constitutional amendment. And so that's really how it all started. And we struggled. We would pass it in the Senate. I think I passed it 3 times in the Senate before I retired in 06. But every time, the bill was referred to a health subcommittee in the House that was composed of, 7-9 members, maybe. And Jimmy Nafee had made sure that the balance on that committee was decidedly pro-choice. So every time we'd pass it in the Senate, it would go to the House, and it would immediately die in the House on a unrecorded voice vote. And that's part of the reason I left the Senate. I was just frustrated that things like that were happening and people didn't know, which is the value of your program, for people to be able to find out stuff that, you know, they're not going to find on the ABC affiliate or the Tennessean or Knox News Sentinel. So, but eventually it did pass. But that's sort of my involvement, is I carried it while it was in the Senate, and ultimately it didn't pass until after I left. But it's now going to be on the ballot. So that's a little bit of the history and my involvement with it.
Now, before that decision, what kind of restrictions on abortion did we have in Tennessee?
Well, we had a waiting period law, a 48-hour waiting period law, which simply provides that, well, let me start over again. We had an informed consent law on the books that was abortion-specific. The listeners should know, in case anybody's ever talking about it, for every medical procedure, by law, there's an informed consent statute that says you should inform the patient of the risks of cataract surgery, you know, losing your sight or whatever it might be. But the statute that was on the books is very general. It just says that the patient should have be informed and give an informed consent to any medical procedure. But there was nothing specific to abortion. And most states, after Roe versus Wade, passed an abortion-specific informed consent law, explaining, you know, things like the risk of cancer, the risks of perforation of the uterus, if the potential impact on fertility issues, the nature of the human being growing inside the body, you know, at what point there was a heartbeat and brain waves and all that sort of stuff, so that the person understood, here's really what I'm doing. You know, this isn't just some glob of tissue or something like that. And that's an informed consent law. Well, we had a good one, pretty good one. Many states have better ones now, but at the time that we passed it in the 80s, it was a pretty good informed consent law. And then we had a waiting period law. And waiting period laws simply say that you can't undergo the procedure until a certain set period of time after you've received the information sufficient for you to consent to the procedure. So under the United States Supreme Court decisions, those kinds of statutes are legal. You can have an abortion-specific informed consent law, and you can have a waiting period law. We also had a law that required that third trimester abortions would need to be performed in the safety of a hospital, that you just couldn't go to some doctor's office that isn't equipped for the complications that can arise from, you know, third trimester abortion. You've got a pretty well-developed baby at that point.
Thank Gosnell.
Thank
Gosnell on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. If you can remember some of the pictures you saw there of Gosnell, you know, those were clearly fully formed little babies. And we said, you know, if you're going to do those, they need to be done in a hospital. I mean, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And obviously women, you know, died. A couple of women died through Gosnell. So those were the things that Planned Parenthood challenged, and our Supreme Court struck them all down. So that's
wow.
What the court did, and that's what we had. And the result is, people need to appreciate is that we are the only state. I mean, here's Tennessee that's got 7 of 9 members of Congress are pro-life, easily 2/3 of the General Assembly, the Senate and the House are pro-life, at least at some pretty strong level. I mean, you had varying degrees of how pro-life somebody kind of is, but you know, our governor's pro-life, our 2 U.S. senators vote pro-life. Lamar's probably a little more questionable at times than Senator Corker's been, but
on that and everything else.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you can have another show on all the everything else, but the reality is we're the only state in the whole Southeast. Now, picture that. I mean, you're talking Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and Kentucky and the Carolinas and Virginia. We're the only one that doesn't have at least an informed consent law or a waiting period law. And we don't have either one. We're the only state in the Southeast. As pro-life as we are, we don't have either one. And actually, every state has both, except for, I think it may be North Carolina or Florida. So virtually every state in the Southeast has both kinds of laws that really do help restrain abortion, help make sure women know what they're doing, and give them time to reflect on it. And we don't have either laws.
And so our numbers have gone up since that decision, because all of the other states around us bring, you know, where they have they have restrictions. They come here where there's no restrictions. Can you give us some kind of idea of how much the numbers have gone up? Do you have anything on that?
Yeah, I do. Actually, when we first got to looking at it, I'll give you a little bit of background. I think we've got a little bit of time here. A few years ago, when we were trying to get this on the ballot and bypass Jimmy Nafini's committee system, I had one of the Democrats, actually, Charlie Curtis, call me in his office. He said, David, I got to really thinking, you know, why is this such a big deal? Because most people think of abortion, you know, as a federal issue, U.S. Constitution, Roe versus Wade. And you know, why are people so, like you, that I respect, so exercised and so adamant about, you know, this constitutional amendment? And he said, I just had my research analyst look at the abortion numbers in Kentucky. And he said, I realized that Kentucky was performing thousands fewer abortions every year than we were. And that actually Shelby County alone did way more abortions than the whole state of Kentucky. And he said, the only thing I could figure is that they have informed consent laws and waiting period laws, and we don't. And he said, now I get it. I understand. And he said, these laws save babies' lives. And I said, yeah, Charlie, I'm glad you've kind of quantified it. And so, to his credit, Charlie went back to some of his Democratic colleagues, and he went to Nafee and said, I will never again not do everything I can to get this amendment to the floor and get it passed and on the ballot, because babies will die if I don't, and I don't care what you think about me. I care more about what God thinks about what I did. So to his credit, that's a little work behind the scenes, and actually some of that, just for your listeners, that year the Democrats had the majority, but we had, I think, 45 Republicans. But Charlie pulled together about 6 Democrats, and they voted with us and voted against Nafee every time to try to get it to the floor. And some of those procedural votes actually cost some of the Democrats in the next election cycle. Those votes were used against them, and that's when the Republicans took control the very next election cycle. So that's a little bit of history there. But going specifically to your question, we pulled the abortion statistics from the Center for Disease Control, the federal government's, you know, Center for Disease Control, and they track abortion statistics. And we were just looking to see, you know, how many abortions the various states have around us. And lo and behold, they not only showed how many abortions were done in each state, but how many abortions were done in each state on women from other states. So, you know, how many Tennessee women, for instance, went to Arkansas to have an abortion, or how many from Arkansas went to Tennessee. And what we found out, among the, I think it was like 45 states that actually collect all the data on abortions, some don't, but Tennessee was, at the time, the 6th highest provider of abortions to out-of-state women in the country. That was according to the CDC's report in November of 2011. And then we went this past year in November and got the next most recent report, and we had moved from 6th to 5th. So, in other words, the people of Tennessee need to understand we're sort of an abortion destination. I mean, if you think about it, that would be a way to describe describe it. You know, go to Florida for beaches and come to Tennessee for abortion. And we now do, I think, of all the women in Arkansas and Kentucky that have abortions, we provide 15% of them. So out of every 100 women that live in Arkansas that have an abortion, Tennessee is responsible for aborting 15 of those.
Wow.
Yeah, and same is true in Kentucky. So most people don't know that. And you know, one of the things that was interesting, and I don't want to, you jump in anytime you want to, but.
No, you're doing fine.
Okay, well, one of the things we had done some polling recently to find out what people thought about abortion in Tennessee. And even the people that identified as pro-choice, not strong pro-choice, but pro-choice or moderately pro-choice in those two categories, a majority of those folks did not like the fact that we were the fifth highest provider of abortions to out-of-state women. Even that shocked their conscience. It's kind of like, you know, I think women ought to be able to have abortions, but I don't want my state to be, you know, the abortion capital of the country or the Southeast, for God's sakes, you know. So I thought that was very interesting that even those who support abortion did not like finding out that we were a place where people went. And so to put it in, you know, real crystal clear terms, I mean, Kentucky, Mississippi, Arkansas, they have real strong pro-life laws. And essentially, Tennessee is the means by which the people of those states can avoid their own state's laws. We're undermining, we not only don't have laws in our state, I mean, don't have them, but we essentially undermine the laws of our sister states.
And you know what makes it so bad, too, is, you know, I would think that the majority of people in Tennessee, the citizens, are pro-life, but because
yeah.
we had an activist liberal court, you know, not only do you have the tragedy of abortion, but you have, once again, the court taking it away from the legislature, taking it away from the will of the people, and just imposing your own will.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, some other show, you probably ought to have some folks come in and talk about the judicial branch of our government and an amendment, constitutional amendment that's going to be on the ballot next November regarding the judiciary. But yeah, four people in the state of Tennessee, four judges on the Supreme Court, only one of them is still on the bench, but they essentially wrote abortion into our state constitution, four people. And the people have never had a chance to say, yeah, we want it or don't want it. And that's, you know, for those that believe in a representative form of government, I mean, that's an anathema to have four people find something in the Constitution that didn't exist for 200 years. And for people to appreciate this, you know, if you don't like what the court did in Roe versus Wade, well, that's exactly what our Supreme Court did. That's the effect.
It's the Tennessee version.
Yeah, it's just
the Tennessee version of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, that's exactly
okay.
what it is. That's a good way to put it. And
okay.
And so, you know, that's why we had to amend the Constitution. In fact, the dissenting opinion by Justice Mickey Barker, who was one of my constituents when I was in the Senate, he said, you know, the court has effectively taken one side on a very controversial social issue and left that other side with no alternative but to amend the Constitution in order to fix it. And that's exactly where we are. One of the other things, and this is a little bit nuanced, but we mentioned Roe versus Wade. And actually what our Supreme Court did was worse than Roe versus Wade. Now, you might think, how can you do something worse than Roe versus Wade? But they did. And for your listeners, let me just explain. When a provision of statutory law is challenged as unconstitutional, the courts have developed what we call standards of review. It's sort of, okay, we're going to, if some things that, for instance, are not fundamental I'm not sure what in the Constitution is not fundamental, but let's say that somebody passes a law that says the speed limit should be 55 on the freeway. And somebody says, well, that somehow is unconstitutional. Well, the Supreme Court would apply a rational basis test. They'd say, well, could a reasonable mind, a rational mind, conclude that there was at least some reason, you know, for having that speed limit, and there's some connection between that speed limit and, you know, some federal constitutional power. And then they have another standard that's sort of an undue burden, you know. And all these people need to understand are what I call lawyer weasel words, because, you know, what's an undue burden on David Vance, you know, may not be an undue burden to me. I mean, you know, the price of gasoline is an undue burden to me, but it probably doesn't bother the Rockefellers, you know. So that's another standard. And then the worst is called strict scrutiny. And it's the highest level of judicial review that's ever been devised by the legal system. Excuse me. And I cannot recall any case where strict scrutiny was applied as a constitutional principle and a statute has been upheld, whether it was under the Commerce Clause or Roe versus Wade or whatever it would be. There's the standard is so high that judges can always second-guess the legislature and say, well, you could have done it a little less harsh than you did or a little more narrowly than you did. You just went a little too far. And that's the standard our court applied. The highest legal standard that's ever been created is the one our court chose to adopt. And what needs to be appreciated is that standard is higher and stronger than the standard the United States Supreme Court imposes on abortion regulations. So we're actually worse than Roe versus Wade.
Wow, I didn't know it was that extreme. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Fowler, this is Bing. I just wanted to get your quick reaction to the Supreme Court ruling on the Arizona. I know this is off topic a little bit, but the Arizona issue, where they basically took away a state's sovereign right to dictate who gets to vote in their state. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hate to say I haven't read that opinion. I'm not comfortable commenting on it, but you know, the states are able to set up our own voting laws. I mean, not the election date, you know, that's set, but we can decide what you got to you know, when you have to register by and all that other sort of stuff, and they have it seems to me that it's one thing for the federal government to say, okay, we're going to have the election on Tuesday in November, but we ought to be able to define who gets to vote and as long as what we do doesn't really violate the Constitution. You know, for instance, if we said African Americans can't vote, well, that violates the 13th Amendment, you can't say that. But if we want to require a driver's license or any other number of things, that, you know, that ought to be able to be required. But people need to appreciate on the abortion issue that we have the toughest constitutional protections for abortion in the entire country. One thing that ought to be noted is that, in fact, there are only 16 states in the whole country that have a state constitutional right to abortion, and all of them were, you know, created by courts. But so Tennessee is in the minority of states that even have a state constitutional right to abortion, and among those 16, ours is the strictest, the toughest. So I mean, it's just unfathomable to me that that's what's true of our state. As pro-life as we are, as many churches as we have, that we are literally, we have the strongest constitutional protections for abortion in the country, including the United States.
Hey, Dave, I've got a lot of questions for you, but I am going to have to take a quick break.
Sure.
And we'll
be
right back and get some more questions in and get some callers in.
Great.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, Dave, LifeLock? Oh. All right, it's our first sale. Dave,
yeah,
are you there?
It's not working.
David LifeLock, conservativenationradio.org is proud to be associated with the most effective identity security and credit monitoring service there is, LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just your standard credit monitoring service. LifeLock helps to protect your general information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There's nothing really that comes close to LifeLock. To protect your identity with LifeLock, go to conservativenationradio.org and click on the LifeLock banner. That's conservativenationradio.org and click on the LifeLock banner.
Whether you're on active duty, a veteran, or just admire American Armed Forces, there's no better place to get the widest variety of militaria than at Highlands Militaria. Highlands Militaria is one of America's premier distributors of Fox tactical gear and outdoor products. Veteran-owned and operated, Highlands Militaria offers new and used uniforms and insignia from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and today, with an emphasis on airborne and special operations insignia, gear, collectibles, and uniforms. If you need to replace a cherished badge or unit patch, or just want to gear up for your next outdoor adventure, go to Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, where you'll find the best supply of the military gear you need. Shipping is always free with one-day handling time, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, and thank you for your service.
If you love America, you're among.
Target your engine! Target your engine!
Hi, this is Eric Darnell.
This is David Reagan.
Jamie McMurray.
This is Carl Edwards here for RED,
the entertainment industry's voice for road safety.
Want to make a difference? It's simple. Be responsible.
Plan ahead. Designate before you celebrate.
Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
Drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be
a public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
And friends don't let friends do talk radio either. I'm speaking of myself, of course.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Radio. This is Dave Vance, your host for tonight's show, along with Bing Fisher. The program is sponsored by Tennessee Action Council. Visit our website at www.tn.foraction.com. Our call-in number for the show is 718-305-7176. We are not professionals. Try this at home here if you want. All right, David Fowler, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here. Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
I want to focus a little bit on Amendment 1.
Okay.
All right. What exactly is Amendment 1 going to accomplish?
Well,
is it going to be the cure-all, or does it just kind of level the field?
No. What it does is it essentially puts the Constitution back in the position it was prior to the Supreme Court's decision. I often tell people, I said it just restores neutrality on the issue of abortion into the Constitution. It no longer takes a side.
So
effectively. It reverses the court's opinion, effectively.
Okay, so the laws that were in effect prior to that will then be back into effect, or will they have to be passed again or take any kind of special action or what?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. No, those laws are gone. So if we can pass the amendment, we'll still have to go back and pass an informed consent law or a waiting period law. And so if people hear this, and they will, just count on it. I heard it on the floor of the Senate. I heard it on the floor of the House. People are going to say that if you vote for this amendment, then, you know, you're voting to ban abortion in Tennessee. Well, the reality is, even if the amendment passes, we still don't have any of these laws in Tennessee. We'll have to go through the normal political process, which, you know, to me, is it should be. That, you know, you elect your representatives, and you go up to the state capitol, and you duke it out for, you know, what kind of laws do you want to have on abortion. So all this does is really restore neutrality to the Constitution, reverse the court's decision, and put the issue back in the hands of the people through their representatives. And if the people, through their representatives, elect a bunch of pro-choice people, well, we'll continue just as we are today.
Yeah. Now, some people, even on our side, even pro-life people, have complained that the language is a little confusing. And I know you've touched on that, too. Can you give us a little history behind that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I can. And actually, it's not very confusing if you have your law degree. But probably a number of voters won't have their law degree. Yeah. And this is why shows like this are so important. Because if you go in and you don't know anything about this until you vote, then, you know, we're going to probably have pro-choice people voting for it, who shouldn't have been, and we're going to have pro-life people voting against it, who should have voted for it. But, it's got a bunch of words there, and the very first sentence is really the controlling sentence. If people just forget all the rest that's down there. The first sentence says that there's nothing in the Constitution that secures or protects a right to abortion or requires the funding of an abortion. And that's the operative language. Now, there's language that follows that says that the people retain the right through their representatives to make provisions regarding abortion in cases of rape or incest for the life of the mother and all that. And that's really restating. All that's doing is restating what the legislature could do. I mean, the legislature can pass abortion laws, or they cannot pass it. But a lot of people read that and they get confused. Now, when we first started, the very first draft that I had, just as a little history, was simply the first sentence. It just says there's nothing in the Constitution about abortion, and nothing requires us to pay for any abortion. And for many pro-life people, that would have been very clear. But the amendment kept getting beat, and the public perception was, and the perception the newspapers gave, and they still sort of do, hate to say they're not real honest about it, but is that, well, for gosh sakes, y'all are so extreme, there's not even a provision to have an abortion in the case of rape or incest or even to save the life of the mother. Well, that really wasn't necessary in the statute because the statute was essentially saying there's just nothing in here about abortion, period, so whatever exceptions you want to go pass,
you have to pass them.
Yeah, go pass them. You know, if you want to allow abortion to be unrestricted, well, go have at it. If you want to allow it in cases of rape, then have at it. You know, just get the votes and pass the law that way. But many people don't appreciate the distinction between a statute and an abortion, and legislators were getting hammered by people emailing and saying, you awful extremist, you know, I'm pro-life, but, you know, if my daughter got raped, I don't know what I would even think, and, you know, to not even have a provision to allow a choice to decide, you know, in cases of rape. Well, you know, trying to explain to people what I've just spent the last 3 minutes explaining on politics, you know, that's not soundbite worthy. It's too complicated. And so legislators were getting beaten up, and we realized that, you know, true enough, we were going to expect Planned Parenthood to be out here selling commercials all over the place saying, you know, radical extremists have taken over the legislature and they don't even want to allow abortion in the case your daughter's been raped, you know.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say is that people would go into the ballot box and read it and say, well, by God, Planned Parenthood is right. It doesn't say anything in here about rape. And they'd vote no. So we added language to say, well, hey, don't sweat it. The legislature can deal with this subject. and can allow abortion in cases of rape if that's what, you know, the people want through their representatives. But so that language was added to counter this argument that was being made that, no, the legislature can deal with cases of rape and incest. What it's unfortunately done is some very pro-life people don't read it right, and they say, oh, so you're giving people a constitutional right to an abortion in case of a rape? Well, you know, a baby conceived by rape is still a baby. And so some strongly pro-life people have been thrown off the other way. But that's why it's worded the way it is. So go ahead with your question there.
So for once in history, the lawyers are not actually to blame for not having straightforward language. It's the fact that people from both sides were confused, right?
Yeah, I mean, really, it was just that case that there was the misrepresentation, and people probably find it hard to believe that Planned Parenthood might misrepresent something, but they did.
And you expect that they're going to continue that pretty much along those lines. That's how they're going to...
Absolutely. I mean, any argument we heard in the General Assembly, I think we have to assume we can hear again in a TV commercial or a radio ad. And that's why that language was added, because we didn't want people to go in the ballot box and read it and not see anything in there about rape or incest and think, well, by golly, for once, Planned Parenthood told the truth. Well, no, they weren't, but, you know, it looks that way. So that's why all the rest of that language was added. And you know, speaking of that, I don't know how much time we've got left, but one of the things people need to appreciate is the process and what opposition we expect. Do you have some time to talk about that?
Yeah, let's go ahead and if we've got any questions on what we've discussed so far, anybody that's holding on the line, go ahead and ask them before we get into this next part, because it's going to be a little thick, and they're going to have to really pay attention to it.
Okay.
Kurt, did you have something that you wanted to ask?
No, I'm good. Let's just, you know, go on with you and Dave out there. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, explain the process, Dave, because everybody's probably thinking, well, you know, hey, we're a pro-life state. You know, David Fowler and Family Action Council are on this, so we're sure everybody's going to vote the right way. Why is that not necessarily the case?
Well, that's really important. People need to appreciate here, and I'll just say this for shock value. We could get 100% of the votes for this amendment, and the amendment would fail. Now, before you think Davey's lost his mind, you know, does he not understand 100% is more than 50%? And I do. You know, my math skills are still good enough. But under our state constitution, a majority of votes, you have to get a majority, but you also have to get a minimum number of votes. And the constitution says that in the governor's race, the year you're voting on this, which is when we'll be voting, for an amendment to pass, it has to get half of the votes that are cast in the governor's race plus one vote. In other words, they didn't want our founding fathers, and I think quite wisely, said, you know, we don't want somebody to put up some amendment that's really stupid that says, you know, Tennessee's going to move to a communistic economic model, and everybody thinks, you know, that ain't going to pass. And the next thing you know, 10,000 committed communists vote for it, and our people just ignore it. And boom, the Constitution's changed. So we have to get a minimum vote. Now, let me give people an example. 2 million people, let's just assume, hypothetically, vote in the governor's race next year. If the amendment gets 1 million votes and the other side gets one vote, we lose. Because our side needed to get a majority, which we did, but we needed to get 1 million and one votes. Half the votes in the governor's race, which would be 1 million, plus one. So, effectively, everybody that goes into the ballot box and votes in the governor's race then reads this amendment, and they haven't listened to your radio show or had the preacher talk about it, or they've been deceived by Planned Parenthood, and they say, you know, I'm not going to vote. I don't understand this. I'm just not going to vote. Well, they will have effectively voted no, and they don't even realize it because they increased the number of votes we have to have, you know, but they didn't vote. So... the effective situation, according to the experts that we've used to help give us some advice, is that historically we should expect about 13% of the voters not to vote on the amendment. A lot of people go in, that's all they do, to vote on the governor's race. So let's just put this in easy math numbers. Let's say you've got 100 people that vote in the governor's race. We got to get 51 votes, right? Half plus one. But only 87 people are going to vote, statistically. So now all of a sudden, it's not getting 50% of the vote. You're effectively having to get, you know, 55, 56% of the vote. Because now you got to get 51 votes out of those 87 that actually vote. So I hope that's understandable. So, you know, 100 people vote in the election. The odds are only 87 will vote on the amendment. But I don't need to get half of 87 plus 1. I still got to get half of 100 plus 1. So the effective passage rate bumps up closer between 55 and 60%. And that's tough when Planned Parenthood's out here potentially spending millions in ads trying to deceive people into what the amendment does.
So how much do you think Planned Parenthood will spend in this? You know, I know they spent quite a bit for something that really wasn't as significant, I think, out in, was it North Dakota, South Dakota?
Yes,
North Dakota. Huge amount of money?
Yeah, they did. You know, we would not be surprised if they don't spend at least $3 million here, maybe four, and it could be even more. I mean, people need to understand that Planned Parenthood is not just fighting this for the state of Tennessee. They're fighting it on behalf of their friends in Mississippi and Arkansas and Kentucky, you know, because our state provides the abortion for their women. So here's the deal. What happened in North Dakota last August is there was a religious liberty amendment on their ballot to amend their state constitution to provide greater protection for religious liberty. 1.97 million, I think it was spent to defeat that amendment. Now, North Dakota has a very small media market. You know, it's not a big state population-wise. In fact, it has a little less than 800,000 people, I think, in the last census. And 1.97 million was spent to defeat this amendment. But of that amount, 90-something percent, 1.393, I believe it was, million, was spent by Planned Parenthood and feminist organizations. And you might think, well, no, wait a minute, that sounds funny. Why wasn't it the ACLU trying to beat this thing and spending all that money? Well, the reason the abortionist spent the money is because if you increase a person's religious liberty protections, you increase the right of a pharmacist, for example, to say, I'm not going to stock and dispense Plan B or RU486. You know, it's Dave Vance's personal pharmacy. You know, he owns his little pharmacy in the town, and he says, I'm just not going to dispense it. Well, the state came by and passed a law and said, no, you are. This religious liberty amendment would have given David grounds to sue the state, say, no, I'm not. Or a nurse who's working in a state hospital. She says, I don't want to do an abortion. I don't want to be a part of that. Get somebody else to do it. Well, this would have given her greater protection. So here was a constitutional amendment that only tangentially touched on the issue of abortion. It was not a direct, quote, a direct attack on abortion. And yet, the feminist organizations spent that much money in North Dakota. To appreciate that, if you took that amount of money per capita in North Dakota and multiplied it times the number of people we have in Tennessee, that would be over $8 million. So if Planned Parenthood and feminist organizations spent the same amount of money in Tennessee per capita as they spent in North Dakota on something that wasn't even directly related to abortion, it would be over $8 million. So, you know, I don't know that they would spend that much, but the other thing people are going to hear, just so they appreciate it, is you're going to hear that, oh, my gosh, you know, Tennessee, here's this strong volunteer state, you know, and you're going to be the first state to ever take away somebody's constitutional right. And you're going to hear that argument. And that's going to appeal to a lot of people, like, well, no, wait a minute. We need more rights. We don't need less rights. We don't want to be the only state that ever took away somebody's right. Well, you know, what your friends and neighbors are going to have to say is, we're not taking away some right. The Supreme Court took away our right to control our own Constitution, and I'm taking it back from the court. And you know, the court had no authority to rewrite our Constitution, and I'm slapping the court now. I'm telling them, don't you ever do this again, and I'll come back and amend my Constitution. And if you're not careful, I may decide to start having direct elections against you and run David Vance for the Supreme Court. So and I would love to see that. That would be fun.
I guess fun would be one way to describe that. But so in translation, we're probably way behind the power curve when it comes to money, because that's basically what we're going to need is money to get the word out, to buy material, to pay for media. And we really can't start soon enough. Now, you know, I mentioned earlier that this show is sponsored by Tennessee Action Council, and as you know, we're going to work with you on that. That's going to be our focus between now and then is Project 2014, and that's what we want to do is raise money to get the material out there, to get the media out there. But what do you have on tap ready to distribute to people? What do you have lined up event-wise or get the word out.
Let me tell you, right now we're trying to put together some of our grassroots contacts in the various states, and I've been spending the last few months, as I'm sure Tennessee Right to Life has, talking to ministers. I mean, one of the most effective things we can do and cheapest things we can do, affordable, is to have preachers willing to get up in the pulpit and say, hey, I'm voting for this amendment, and you better do it too. But we are looking to maybe have, there's a campaign that hopefully will have a campaign website up pretty soon called Yes on One, and eventually that's the website where you could go through and order a bumper sticker or a yard sign and all that. Of course, we won't need to have those out till next year, but if people want some information about what you and I have talked about already today on our website, and I don't know if y'all have a link to it on your website or not. I think you may be.
I'm not sure either, but I know we have information about 2014 and about voting yes on Amendment 1.
Okay. But we have a little brochure. If they went to our website that says Amendment Number 1, you can click on the icon, and you can print it out and take it to your church or your pastor or download it on a flash drive and take it to, Copy Depot or something and run out 100 of them and hand them to your friends. So if people want that, we've already put something together with essentially what we've talked about, the fifth highest provider of abortions and all that. So that's the...
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, but I want to at least take one call on this.
Okay.
John, are you there?
Yeah.
You have a question?
Okay, yeah. This is Johnny McDaniel. I'm heading up the Facebook part of Tennessee Action Council social media and on the board. The thing I was wondering is, wouldn't it be good to try and catch this whole process more by surprise? I know that Planned Parenthood and others would throw a lot of money at trying to defeat it, but if you have a grassroots thing pretty well quickly that would get in touch somehow with the ministers and try and enlist some support, just within, a short amount of time, if you had some funding from conservative groups around the country ready to go into this quickly and get this on a ballot that could come up soon after the effort started, couldn't you kind of beat them to the punch without just having to go on in a protracted way for months and months and even years and give them a lot of notice and enable them to gather a head of steam against us since we've got the support in the legislature? And it seems like we could get the jump on them here if we started quickly and got this done as soon as we could after the process was initiated onto a ballot of some sort.
Well, I'm a little confused about your question. I mean, there's two things. One is the campaign to get the amendment passed. The second thing is if it passes, we obviously want to go back and quickly hop in front of the legislature and pass an informed consent law and a waiting period law. And right now, I think if we can pass the amendment, our legislature is pro-life enough that we will be able to pass those statutes. And I think Planned Parenthood knows that they don't have control of the legislature anymore. They've been long gone at this instant. So the question is, they've got to defeat the amendment. And it's no secret. They know that there's going to be a campaign. So it's not like we could show up 2 months before the election and all of a sudden say, surprise, Okay. We're running a campaign, and if we're not careful, you know, the one thing you want to do when you're campaigning is you want to set the agenda. You want to set the message. You don't want the other side defining the issue in the campaign, because then you spend your whole time in your campaign undermining the wrong message and trying to get your message out. So I think it's very important, and as David said, I mean, raising, you know, a few million dollars, if that's what we need to do, I don't know enough people to make a phone call to, you know, raise that kind of money that short. So,
well, my thought is it wouldn't cost a lot of money to run it through the legislature, would it, and get these bills, amendments passed there while the numbers are good as they are. Maybe getting it, maybe it would cost some money to have some sort of public campaign if the public had to vote on this, of course, but you could pass it through the legislature rather quickly and surely, couldn't you, without a lot of money?
Well, I think we can pass an informed consent law and a waiting period law through the legislature without spending a dime. I think so. What David and I were talking about is that when November rolls around and it's on the ballot and people have to go to the ballot, we can anticipate Planned Parenthood will have probably spent millions on TV advertising, reaching those people out in the middle who don't pay a whole lot of attention, trying to convince them to vote against the amendment. And that's where if we don't have a presence, if the only information that the average Tennessean out there, that group of 50% or 60% in the middle, if the only thing they get is a Planned Parenthood advertisement on TV or radio, then we'll lose. And that's what we're talking about needing the money is to run some TV commercials in, you know, September and October going into that vote to counter the TV commercials and the radio ads that Planned Parenthood will be showing. So I hope that clears it up.
Well, yeah, well, I was thinking that probably you could raise money nationally for something like that if they thought that they could get the ball rolling somewhere like here and the legislature was behind it all.
Yeah, I think we can raise money nationally. I think there will be groups that will want to support our effort from across the country. In fact, our organization is associated with Family Research Council, Tony Perkins, and Focus on the Family, and they've already indicated, you know, we will help send out emails, we'll help try to connect you with people who can support this effort. So this is going to be, you know, this is going to be a national war, just like, you know, Massachusetts became ground zero in California for gay marriage. Tennessee is going to become ground zero for the United States on this issue of abortion. They'll be talking about this everywhere. Pardon me?
So, I said, yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is there any reason not to pursue this as quickly as possible through the legislature rather than waiting for some subsequent time frame?
Well, I mean, you could pass something, I guess, through the legislature and say that it doesn't become effective until, you know, January of 2015. You could do that. But if you passed it now and tried to make it effective now, it would probably be unconstitutional already because the court case is still there.
It might be easier to raise money for it if they saw that that hurdle had been passed.
Well, I mean, that's certainly something maybe to consider that we hadn't thought about, is whether it would be worth trying to pass something, even if it's not effective until afterwards, just so people know, you know, okay, if we vote for the amendment, what kind of law we're going to have, we can say, well, you know, here it is. If you like that law, then, you know, vote for the amendment.
You know, help us make this law, and we passed it. Now we just need the help with the voters.
Amendment,
and then
yeah.
Maybe raise some money, you know, raise some money that way.
I see what you're talking about. I wasn't understanding your question there fully, but that's a point that we need to sit down and think through and talk with some of the legislative leaders about that too.
Hey, okay. Dave, we're going to try to take one more call, and then we're going to have to take a break here pretty quick. Let me see if I can get this guy on the line here.
Okay.
Are you there? Hello?
Yeah.
You have a question? Okay. All right. I can't hear the caller. Bing, I'm going to turn it over to you for a second. We need to go ahead and take a break. Dave, I appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you.
We'll definitely have you back. and get you on again as quick as we can, and we look forward to working with you on this.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate all the help of the Action Coalition and your help, and I hope that me, if this was your first show, me being on it, doesn't cause your listenership to completely collapse next time you... I'll be on the air. Okay.
I think I might be perfectly capable of that on my own. But hey, I appreciate you coming on.
Okay. Thank you. Blessings.
Great help.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a few minutes, and we'll have Bill Warner right after the hour.
There's no time to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute that you save. Legal tender's never gonna change the number on your days. The highest cost of living's dying, that's one everybody pays. So have it spent before you get the bill. There's no time to kill. If we'd known 10 years ago today would be 10 years from now, would we spend tomorrow's yesterday and make it last somehow? Would be the cheers in someone else's game to never learn to play.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Radio. This is Dave Vance. Program is sponsored by Tennessee Action Council. Check out our website, www.tn4action.com. Our phone number to call in is 718-305-7176. Next caller.
Hey, Dave.
Hello?
I'd like to hey, Dave, I'd just like to get this in real quick, if I could.
Yep.
Yeah, hear this, man. Join former U.S. Navy SEAL Carl Higbee on the Sound of Freedom with Hig and Risch, Thursdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central. Carl is a well-known author of Battle on the Home Front and an outspoken critic of the Obama administration. I wish I had some sound effects for that. But, hey, who isn't these days? And congratulations to his broadcast partner, Guy Ressenthaler, who was elected last month, I think it's almost 2 months ago, as Pennsylvania magistrate judge. So listen to Sound of Freedom with Hig and Risch, Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central on conservativenationradio.org. Real conservatism for real conservatives. Take it away, Dave.
Okay. Hey, you know, I think probably a lot of people didn't, number one, don't know the process that David was talking about in terms of getting an amendment through. I believe a lot of people probably just assume, since we are a pro-life state, all you have to do is put up pro-life legislation. But, you know, as he explained, that's not the case. So we're really going to have to, put our nose to the grindstone on this one, do everything we can to raise money and get the information out there to people so that, we can actually win this fight. And, you know, even for people that might not be as pro-life as a lot of us are, they should at least resent that the Supreme Court stepped in and took over versus letting the legislature.
Well, yeah, it's state sovereignty, man, in my opinion. You know, they're stepping all over us.
Oh, yeah. And that's not the first time or the first topic. Okay, I think we've got Bill Warner. I think he just popped up, and we're gonna go back to what we started off with Kurt talking about, the Manchester event. Let me verify. I'm pretty sure this is Bill. Bill Warner.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Bill. Doing fine. Appreciate you being on the show with us. I think most of the Tennessee listeners are familiar with you. Most of them have probably attended a seminar, watched the tape, or seen a film, maybe bought a book. But, Manchester's been in the news a little bit lately.
Well, of course, there's Bonnaroo. Of course.
Well,
I don't call Bonnaroo. Well, I guess the first Bonnaroo was historic, but I wouldn't call the. How long have they been doing that now? 10 years?
I think the first Bonnaroo was actually called Ichiku. That's
the original one.
Ichiku
was, yes.
Yeah, and it was only about maybe 8 people there.
Well, there were more than 8 people at our Ichiku, I'll tell you that. We had a packed house.
Now you were inside. I know I was there. Bing was there. Kurt was there. None of us got to go in, but you were inside.
You didn't get to go inside.
Yeah, I was there. I just didn't get a chance to go in. I didn't get there in time to go inside.
Right. Well, it was a historic event in many ways, but I think the most historic part about it is that for once we commandeered and commanded the information battle space. I've been going to these events where you have Muslims, some members of government, and unfortunately frequently some member of the clergy who are up front of the room, and it's just a big love fest. I tell you, everybody is so sweet. It's like cotton candy, rainbows, and unicorns. But this didn't work out quite like that. It's more like a Missouri mule than a unicorn. So, do we want to go into a brief summary in case anybody hadn't heard this?
Let me start off here a little bit. The whole thing, well, allegedly this thing was in response to a Facebook posting that the commissioner, Barry West, Democrat, by the way, not one of us crazy right-wing Republicans, he was a Democrat, posted something on Facebook, how to wink at a Muslim, and picture of him holding a double-barrel shotgun looking down the barrel winking. So, and that caused a little stir in the Muslim community there. And that was, I guess, the excuse they used for the event. But now, since that time, I think you may have seen the letter from the county attorney.
Yes, that was astounding. I mean, that really put the cherry on top as far as being on the winning side for once.
Yeah. Before we get into everything that went on there, what did you think about the letter? Let's talk about that letter a little bit.
Well, what the letter did was, it was a reprimand. If a county attorney can reprimand somebody from DOJ, I mean, of course, the federal government is used to the brown stuff rolling downhill. They don't ever see it pushed uphill. So, but I lost my thought of my own humor there. Remind me where I was going.
they're not used to getting it thrown back at them.
No, they're not. Not at all. But anyway, he threw it back at them because basically he said, look, you know, it was a joke. Come on, it was a joke on Facebook. And you know what? We handled it quite well. He apologized more than once, met with the offended members of the community, and it was all over. As a matter of fact, when the gentleman, who's the key MB Muslim Brotherhood player in that part of the world, said, you know, we had this event, but he said, that is done and over. He says, I don't want to talk about it. That's all been resolved. And that's what the county attorney said. He said, look, this was all worked out. And then you had to come down here and basically incite this crowd together because of what you said about hate speech and hate crimes and basically threaten freedom of speech, which he did. That letter in the interview in the Tullahoma paper with Assistant Attorney General Killian, that went all across the United States. And I think that's something that needs to be said. Although Manchester, I'm told, has 10,000 people in it, this was not a local event. My friend Janet Levy did not fly in from Los Angeles to have a local political meeting. As she said, this affects the entire nation. So Killian created basically a reverberation throughout America in terms of, like, you know, what does this freedom of speech thing mean? Does that mean we can offend a Muslim? Well, that was sort of what he raised the question of, well, maybe you can't. Well, of course, so anyway, Killian incited the meeting. And, of course, the county attorney pointed that out to him. And he used the word incite twice in the letter. And I think the listening audience needs to know that the word incite in legalese has a certain ominous tone to it. It means you stirred them up to do this. And I think the county attorney went ahead and said, and if there is any damage to Muslims, it will be because of you, because you incited them. So he jerked him up short on the chain. as much as he can. And the other thing I liked was he reminded him, he says, you know, you were a county attorney, too, at one time. I think Marion County, I may be making that up. And he said, how would you like it if the federales came down to your turf and didn't even give you a fare thee well, an email, a phone call, a note, a memo, a nothing? And he says, it is your right to do so, but he said, it certainly lacks in courtesy. In short, you were rude. Killian had some burr under his blanket, which we don't know what it is, but I strongly suspect, since an event similar to this is going to show up here in Nashville on Thursday night, but at a much reduced low-key version, we have another federal agent, a member of DOJ, showing up, this time in a church, to rattle on about, you know, hey, this free speech and this Islam thing, I don't know how well they're going to get along here. So I don't think that Killian got the idea on his own to come to Manchester. I think that it came from up above him, Department of Justice. I think originally this meeting originated, in a sense, in the White House, and that I see this as part of President Hussein's attempt to Islamicize the nation. And so anyway, but the... And by the way, you know there was another letter written by Representative Shipley, who's head of some state of Tennessee judiciary committee. And he basically wrote him a letter, too. Did you see that one?
Yeah, I saw that one. I don't remember as much about it, but I remember
basically,
he said, reading it.
This event does not even remotely approach hate crime, does not remotely approach a freedom of speech issue. What are you doing? You're just down here stirring stuff up. I guess Killian had heard when he was back as a boy, if you'll stir the brown stuff in a bucket, it'll stink. Well, I guess he found out it will.
So you think it came directly from the White House? That's your opinion?
I don't think it was a direct order. I think you serve in the military, don't you?
I'm retired.
Okay. But a leader has two ways that he works. One is on hard specifics. These are direct memos. These are hard evidence. But there's something else that a leader establishes, and that is a tone, okay, which is never written down anywhere. But people get the idea what pleases and doesn't please the leader. And so I don't think there was a direct order from the Obama White House go down to this, but I think it has filtered down through the system that they are to support Islam everywhere they can. So anyway, we wound up.
Now they were invited by AMAC, right? AMAC invited. Right.
Yeah, but that's sort of a hand in glove relationship, because I think we'll understand that AMAC also works hand in glove here with Bill and Bill. Bill Gibbons and
yeah.
Bill.
Well, also I thought they were invited by the Southern Poverty Law Center. I thought they had a little part in that game.
Well, they could have. Of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center likes to run around anywhere it can to pick up some leavings and dribs and drabs. I, of course, have a very special relationship with the Southern Poverty Law Center. I'm one of their biggest fans.
You on the hate list?
One of America's top 10 bigots. So yeah, I need a little respect on the other end of the line here. I mean, it ain't often you get to talk to a top 10 at anything. But it wow, dude.
Bill, dude, I've been wanting to get on that list forever, and it's like I can't get on it. I've been trying.
Yeah.
I can't
get on
it. You
know what? Send me an
Bill,
email,
you know,
and I'll see if I can throw some weight around, and we'll see if we can get you. Because they love a top 10 list of hate. As a matter of fact, that's how the Southern Poverty Law Center makes its money, basically is drawing up hate lists. And
well, that's what they are, and you know, it was fun. I was there with Dave, and Pam Geller was just, she was on fire, man. And she came from New York City.
Crowd, can't she?
Yeah. She. I don't want to get in a fight with her. No.
But
I was talking to some people outside that meeting, man. I could not figure out why so many Mennonites were there. Did you see them out there?
Those aren't Mennonites.
They don't.
No, those aren't Mennonites.
They're not?
No, they are a messianic church that adheres to some degree to the Torah and Judaic law, but they're Christians.
Oh, okay.
And I've met these people before, and I've seen a whole room full of them here in Nashville, and observations are is their children are polite, respectful, quiet. The big children take care of the little children. These look like exemplary family members, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, but, I was just wondering who they were. I didn't know who
they were. I can understand why you would think they're Mennonites, but they're not.
Oh, well, good. Hey, I tell you what, I appreciate you shedding light on that.
Bill, I've got a couple things here. Number one, I was glad to read that letter by that attorney. You know, it's good to see a county attorney stand up to a federal agent.
Yeah,
we need more of that. Matter of fact, we need state representatives and state senators to stand up to the feds. Now, Tony Shipley wrote his letter. I know we had some reps there. But, you know, there were no – it seems kind of strange that you have somebody from the DOJ and the FBI coming to Coffee County, Tennessee, to basically bully the citizens there.
Mm-hmm.
And – there was no official representation from the Haslam administration unless you count AMAC, since they do have a partnership.
Oh, you have a wicked sense of humor there, Jay.
So I'm just curious. I mean, you know, I'm glad to see this county attorney stand up, but I think the county attorney, I would encourage him to write a letter to the Haslam administration and say, hey, where were you?
Well, this is true, although I'm not sure that Bill Haslam wanted to be anywhere near such an event.
Yeah,
I don't think they
own AMAC. Okay, what they get by with in this state is because of that partnership, and that's my personal belief anyway. And
I could not agree with you more. And as a matter of fact, that's something in terms of our politics that we have to deal with. I think at some point in the game, we have to find a way to approach the Haslam administration and tell him, look, you must hear all the voices about Islam. You will only hear the Muslim Brotherhood side. How can you, as a governor of a state in which 99% of the people are not on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood, and say, that's quite all right, citizens, I don't care, because your 99% doesn't mean anything to me. I am going to stand by the Muslims, and I'm not going to stand by you. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm not going to speak to you. I'm not going to acknowledge you. Somehow we need to put pressure on him that he says, all right, you're correct. This issue has more than one side. Because what our governor wants to say is, when it comes to Islam, there is only one side of the discussion. The other side of the discussion is some form of evil and disgusting, and I won't hear it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's pretty much what he's told us in the past for all practical purposes. So were you surprised at how many people showed up?
No. No, I was not. I had a feeling about this. Now, let me warn you. As my wife will tell you, I am the eternal optimist. Because I told her, I said, we're going to get at least 1,000 people. She says, Bill, if we fill the hall, we'll be doing well. But when it was over, she said, okay, Bill, you were right on that one. And the reason I thought that is that my email inbox was just rattling. So many things were coming into it. And there was on the talk radio thing, listen, this was the perfect storm. The web rattled around and talked about this for about 2 weeks, and then about a week before the event, talk radio cut in. So with the web, we brought in people from New York, Georgia, and other places, but from talk radio, we brought in an awful lot of people from this area, and people were – this was a tipping point, in my opinion. I've been doing this business of going around to Muslim Brotherhood meetings and giving talks to people about Islam for 11 years, and I think – now, remember, I'm the eternal optimist, but I think we've reached a tipping point here. I think people have realized that finally it's settling in. Obama is real. He's here to destroy us. Islam is real, and it's here to destroy us. And if we are thinking that our leaders, whether they occupy a pulpit or an elected office, are going to protect us, we've been smoking funny weed. Because it's very clear that all of those guardians who are supposed to protect us, whether it's law enforcement, the military, elected officials, church officials, they're not going to do it. They have shown now, when I say they, I'm talking about the 90%.
Right. You know, there's exceptions to every rule.
I love that. They blame it on the weed, man. I don't see. You know, I mean, I just don't see any other way around it. But you're listening to Inside Tennessee with Dave Vance. And great show so far, man. Great guest, great show. 718-305-7176. That's 718-305-7176 is the call-in number if you want to get on here. Dave, you want to do just a quick read and do a couple PSAs and we'll round up the show? Or you round up the show. It's your show.
We've still got a little time. I still got a few more questions. If we need to take a break, we'll take a break and come back. I'm gonna hand over the technical duties to you. I'll ask the questions if that's all right for tonight.
Oh, why are you doing that? Don't do that, man.
Hey, Bill, I want to. You said something a minute ago. Elected officials. You know, all these years after 9/11 and everything that we've seen go on since then. I think if you have an elected official now that is either too apathetic or too stupid to recognize this threat, you shouldn't even vote for the guy. You shouldn't even consider voting for that person. And I think most of the people that were at that rally were probably trained by Bill Warner, and they probably know more about those issues than most of the representatives do.
I would say that it is tragically true. Remember I mentioned my friend Janet Levy, who came in from L.A., and she said, I've never been in a room that was so filled with people who knew politics and Islam. She says, I was stunned by that. She says, people were not just, you know, we're characterized, I'm a hater, by the way. That's the one-word summary. The fact that I've spent 40 years studying a subject and have reached some conclusions about it just means, oh, he's a hater. But we have finally here in Middle Tennessee, now this is my own peculiar personal take on it, but the Muslim Brotherhood made the mistake of wandering into my backyard. And I've been laying groundwork in this part of the country for 10 years, giving talks, lectures, books, everything. And so what we see here, and this is the reason I'm optimistic, without leadership help, an educated grassroots populist basically threw the rascals out. I mean, we hammered them. We hammered them. And I don't think those men, by the way, I love the way the county attorney said, and then after you incited the crowd, this is talking about Killian, you sneaked out the back door. And he did. We ran him off because he didn't have anything to say. He wasn't even firing blanks. I mean, it was just click, click, click. So, but here we saw what an educated populace can do. And we ruled. We prevailed. Now then, the question is, can we find ways to follow this up? I mean, this was a David and Goliath moment. Listen, when you are an assistant attorney general for the Eastern District of the United States, your boss is Eric Holder, okay?
Yeah.
And when you are the special agent in charge, your boss is Mueller. These were not some low-ranking officials. These people were like colonels in the military, okay? These were important people. And we gave them a dose. We did not like what they had to say. Yeah. And for once, they heard a citizen talk back.
Yeah,
because we're supposed to just kneel and pray at their feet.
Speaking of talk, we're going to talk some more in a minute, but we're going to take a...
Oh, yeah, I was just going to interject something real quick. It's funny because I got there over an hour early, and I didn't see anybody really enter the building. I wasn't looking out the back where they were running, though, you know, when they left, because they did leave out the back. But...
No, they did leave out the back. They did not leave out the front door.
Yeah.
Even
like
the media knows that, like, hey, they won't even the media. I'm told I don't watch TV, which is one day I'll get my citizenship jerked on that, I suppose. But anyway, there were three stations there, and one of them said, "Well, you know, this is a bunch of redneck haters." But the other two were like, "You know, these were citizens who were angry at the government," and so I just think that we had a it was a wonderful thing to me. Dave, this is something that you and I could have dreamed about but would have never thought we would have ever really seen. An assistant attorney general basically driven off the stage, a special agent in charge hooted at, Ruby Ridge, Fort Head, Fort Hood, Waco.
I gotta tell you, too, I love my man Joe Carr getting up there doing that speech. That was a great speech. And I want to see him in Congress.
I like Joe a lot. The thing I like about Joe is he's real. I don't think he can deal from the bottom of the deck.
No, I don't think so either. I don't think he's good at that. He would never be the kind of gambler on TV or something, you know. But
no, what you see is what you get.
I
find that refreshing. I don't even have to agree with you all the time if I just think you're honest about it.
No, that's
we're
going to
take
thing.
A quick break, and when we come back, we got some more questions for you, Bill. Appreciate you being here.
Oh, love talking about it.
Thank you, Bill.
It's easy to take your world for granted. Most days go by without a whole lot of surprises. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if everything familiar becomes anything but? Would you be prepared? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee. This is Dave Vance with Conservative Nation Radio. We've got our guest with us is Dr. Bill Warner. Call-in number is 718-305-7176. This show is brought to you by Tennessee Action Council. Bill, I had a few more questions for you. We've still got a little bit of time here. And once again, I appreciate you being with us.
Glad to
be there,
here.
Bill?
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So with this event, I mean, is this the new standard, or what do we do from here?
Well, I think we need to see what was successful, and then we need to see what we can carry forward with. The event was successful. We shellacked the Muslim Brotherhood. All right, we commandeered their event. It was our party, not theirs. So. Now then, here's the deal. These events crop up all the time. This one just happened to have Killian basically saying that freedom of speech didn't apply when it comes to Muslims. These events are usually smaller and don't get that kind of coverage. They may only occur in a church bulletin and on a website, but they go on all the time. And what we need to do is we need to oppose the Muslim Brotherhood every time it puts its foot down someplace to speak. Now, we cannot oppose them by trying to get 1,500 people to show up. That is not practical. But remember, this event in Manchester, they only put out originally 100 chairs. What that says is they figured if they could get 50 people, they would be lucky. I put on events. That's the way you think. Well, we maybe get 50, so we'll set out 100 chairs. If that meeting had not had 15,000 in it, we could still have dominated the meeting, but used another medium. That is, instead of trying to overpower by bringing in 1,500 people, if we had merely 15 people there, a fat dozen, we can still commandeer the meeting, but not through shouting. What we need to do for meetings is to have our own material that we custom make and hand out for that meeting itself. And we need to find a way to commandeer the meeting. In my opinion, what we do is we come into meetings like this, and before the meeting starts, we have a team. And this team has divided up the brochures that they're going to hand out until, let's say you have 10 people, you divide them into 10 piles. You stand up as a group, and you saturate the crowd with your brochures, and then you sit down. Well, now then, they're getting ready to call the meeting to order. But what are people going to do? What has just happened is not part of the meeting. So people are going to read the brochure that's now in their hand. The brochure will oppose the spiel that's going to happen in the room. So we need to have a little intel so we know how to write our brochure, if you will. But that way, what we've done is we have taken and put our voice into the room. Because you have to understand, these events are designed to only have a voice for the Muslims and their supporters, in this case, the federal government. So what we have done now is we have taken a situation by handing out brochures. And by the way, the nice thing about, there's many good things about brochures. You have time to reflect and write them. You don't have to be a skilled speaker in public. Everybody now has your message. And it didn't take any time and space. And you, because don't, I know that people say, well, you ought to just sit there politely and then ask your question at the end of the meeting. Good luck. That happened in the very beginning. See, my wife and I started going to these 11 years ago. And 11 years ago, you actually got to ask a question from the floor. Okay? Well, no longer. You're not getting it. Because they quickly found out, whoa, you don't want people asking questions because guess what? They know too much, and they ask what you think are what Muslims would think of as like bad questions. So we can commandeer the meeting in the sense of putting our message out first with very few people. As I said, 10, a dozen will do the job in most cases. So, and another thing that's effective, by the way, is to use a banner that also addresses one key point. And the banner, here's the reason you want to take a banner instead of a poster. A lot of times they won't let you take posters into meetings, particularly if they've got a stick on them. So by taking a banner in, and what we're going to use in our next meeting is we're just going to take a bed sheet. They're $2 at Goodwill. And you take and you make you a banner that you can stuff in a jacket, and then two people can spread out. So that, again, I come back to the point. We have a brochure. We hand it out and saturate the meeting with our information before they start. And part of the complaint of the brochure needs to be, by the way, is how come we don't ever get to ask real questions from the floor? So if we do this consistently, all right, what we will do is we will learn how to write better brochures and put better teams in place so that every time the Muslim Brotherhood speaks, we are there first. And I think that's a tactic we need to try because it's very practical. You can do it with a few people. You don't need a 1,500. And it can be done in some out-of-the-way town because, look, we have one piece of information that they're going to do 10 more of these, okay? And we need to be there for every one of them. We need to make it such when the Muslim Brotherhood holds a meeting, they're a little anxious because they know we're coming.
So do we know where these 10 are, or we just know there's 10 more?
Someone said, and I don't even check the information, what we have now is we've got people with Google Alerts, and we can easily keep up when the next one's going to be. So,
do you expect them to do anything different? I mean, are they just going to hopefully keep – is it their goal going to be, okay, let's keep it under the radar and stack the deck?
You know, I don't think they want a big publicity thing right after this one. I mean, this did not work out well for them. And you got to know this is doubly disappointing. Not only did it not work out, this was the first time. This was a man bites dog story. Okay, so now let me say this. They will come back. The Muslims have a very good doctrine of losing a game and how to respond. The Quran even addresses this. And the reason you didn't win, Muslims, is you were not Islamic enough. So they have a whole – they're very good at bouncing back from loss because Muhammad kept bouncing back from loss. So they'll keep coming back. But I think we're now at a tipping point where – I think two things are going to happen. I think we're going to see some sort of alliance out of all the different groups, because here's another thing that has to change. We can't make every meeting an ad hoc meeting.
No.
We can't. We have to put together a permanent alliance
structure
of communication.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean when we do this, of course, one of the problems in trying to get people like you and me and others to do this is you're going to try to coordinate everyone who heads up a citizens group like Tea Party or 912. They're all alphas. They're all alphas.
No. Say it ain't so.
Yeah. So all of these people are the nail that stands up and will not be driven down. So this alliance cannot be have any hint of we're going to tell your organization what to do. So this alliance needs to be people who realize, wasn't it Ben Franklin that said we either hang together or we'll hang separately?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to put ourselves in an alliance together that will keep up in communication so that let's say that in a month's time, oh, by the way, there won't be Ramadan starts soon, and they don't usually do much mischief during Ramadan. But after that is over, they'll be coming out looking for fresh meat, and it could be, let's say it's in Dyersburg, just making that up as I go. So the people in Dyersburg, if they were part of this alliance, could easily get help like, hey, they're coming. Does anybody have a brochure that's already designed we can hand out? So I think, however, remember, I'm the foolish optimist. If I weren't an optimist, I wouldn't have started this 11 years ago because it's been a long, dry spell, let me tell you. But I think we've reached a turning point here. I think people have realized we can win. We can win.
Yeah, if you show up, you can win. If you have a plan, you can win. You just can't sit
exactly.
back and be on defense all the time.
Exactly. Go ahead.
Within Tennessee, what are the – and some people listening to us already know this, others might not. Who are some of the key individuals and organizations in Tennessee that are supporting the Islamists, and how deep is the infiltration? Now, obviously, our governor is, you know, lost in a sauce on this, but that's my question to you.
Well, you know, there are – down at the legislature, which I know a little bit about, I learned the legislature from Miss Bobby Petray, who there are some legislators who think she came with the original cornerstone of the building, and she does not ever do anything to dissuade them from that. So I got taught about the legislator from a master. And what you see is that overall, the Tennessee legislature is more enlightened about Islam than any other such body. Having said that, remember, there are both a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans there. Now, Dave, I hate to break this to you, but there are Republicans who are not really on our side.
No, say it isn't so.
No, really? Really?
Yeah. You know the word rhino? Well, it's
way too well.
So, but there
GOP,
are,
Gang of Progressives, and that's the cleaned up version.
Yep. The other place where Islam has found a happy home, and I just issued another newsletter today, is called, The Church of the Poodle.
Oh,
in that, I hate to break this news to you, too, but there are far too many churches which have a styrofoam preacher up front. He may look good, but he ain't got no substance to him. And what is happening is that time and time again, now, by the way, these dialogues that Christian ministers and Jewish rabbis like to go to, they need to know that the dialogue business was planned back in 1990 by the Muslim Brotherhood. They looked and saw that the ministers were basically running a happy club for Sunday morning, and that as such, they could be taken. And by Jove, that's what they decided to do, and they have done enormously successfully well. Actually, I lay the state of the Republican Party on the state of the pulpit. Now, that's something you don't hear many other places. But I think that the pulpits have abandoned to such a large degree dealing with difficult subjects. It's just like, well, we'll just smile and roll off of that, and if it displeases people, we just won't talk about it. I've spoken in churches, and I say you have laid down the gospel of Christ and taken up the gospel of nice. And the bad news is Jesus was not a nice man. He was a kind man, but he was not what you would call a nice man because he would speak truth to power.
Yeah.
And the modern minister doesn't
like,
want to speak truth to power.
Yeah, terms of endearment like sons of hell and ye vipers.
So anyway, so the strength of the Muslim Brotherhood lies in the in the universities, which are run basically by the Muslim Student Association. So we have trouble in the universities, the school system. We have trouble with many elected officials. Well, we definitely have trouble in the pulpits. So I'm afraid that's when I wrote the newsletter about this, that it appears as though our salvation lies in Tennessee rednecks.
Oh, dear God, help us all.
Well, hey, if that's what it takes.
Hey, I'm up for it, you know. Dr. Warner, please give us some links to some areas where we can find some information from you on this.
Well, I run a website called politicalislam.com, and on it I sell books, and I like to give what I think are pithy little penetrating, insightful newsletters. Sometimes I get Muslims who write me and tell me they're not very insightful at all, but I ignore them anyway. So, but politicalislam.com. And you can buy some of my books. By the way, the reason I sell books, since I sell books, that's the reason that the Tennessean, not only have I been maligned by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but the largest newspaper in Tennessee has informed people that I'm KKK, neo-Nazi, and the merchant of hate because I sell books.
All rolled into one with a bow tie.
All rolled into one.
You know, Dave, I was sitting there thinking, how much? I wonder how much this cost, this rally here in Manchester cost the average Tennessee taxpayer, and not just not just Tennessee, but the average taxpayer in the country. How much did this cost? I mean, it had to cost some money. I had to see at least 20 cop cars out there. At least
I have. Let me tell you, inside that building was about as safe as you could be. I don't want to know how many civilians we're carrying. Actually, I must say, on this one event, I specifically did not carry. But there were more cops. And by the way, some of the cops were kind of grinning.
No, there was a lot that was actually talking and so on. There was some Homeland Security there that I seen. It would be interesting to find out how much money this cost the city, the state of Tennessee, and the Republic.
Well, I know this. They wouldn't spend the money on us. There were at least six FBI agents in there.
Yep.
We got a couple. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Dave.
We've got a couple callers on the line. We've got a few minutes left.
Bring them in.
See if you can take a couple calls here. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Hey, this is Scott Osborne from California, Contending for Truth Radio. How you guys doing? You're doing a great job. This is an awesome show today.
Hey, brother Scott, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Bing. Let me tell you, Bill, you just hit the nail on the head. Heavy. It's like
I did.
Or whoever it was. Let me tell you, we've got a situation in our country right now where our pulpits, our churches, they're not even teaching any kind of morality. So we got a bunch of young conservatives that have not been told that it's there's a problem with just two people living together. So then when we come to the discussion of homosexuality and gay marriage, they really don't understand because the pulpits haven't done it. Our pulpits have been nothing for the last 20 years but a place of entertainment. People go to church anymore. They go to hear a band. They go to be entertained. They don't go to have a serious.
It could be Super Bowl Sunday.
Exactly. Exactly. And if we don't, that's where we're losing out on a huge portion of our voters. Well, number one, 2/3 of the Christians don't vote. Neil Mammon pointed that out to us this last year. But it's because they don't understand the morality behind some of these issues. The church is supposed to be the salt of the earth. The churches in Tennessee are the ones that are supposed to be educating people on morality, on abortion, on gay marriage, on all of those issues that are relevant in the moral side of republicanism. You know, Phyllis Schlafly did a great job 40, 50 years back of bringing together the sovereignty side, the moral majority side, and the economic side of the Republican voter. And we're split again. We're entirely split again. Mm-hmm. And we've got a situation in our country where anybody that I talk politics with under 30, they can be very, very conservative on sovereignty issues, on economic issues. They could care less when it comes to morality. And so I really do. I think, boy, when you said that, you perked my ears up. I wasn't going to call in. I was just going to listen all the way through. But that is key. And if we don't get back in our churches to just preaching what is truth, and we don't have to be mean about it, we don't have to be rude about it, but we're not educating in that spot. And that's a huge portion of where we're losing our voters.
I agree with you 100%. If you were listening earlier, I even blame the state of the Republic. Actually, you're repeating what I said, but in a different and better way. I blame the state of the Republican Party on the pulpit, which is just what you said.
Exactly. You know, and there used to be a time, Scott, that we did this. And actually, they still do this in black churches, but it's in black churches, but it's for the opposite side. And it's time that we got together as people and said, look, we demand this from our leaders, from our preachers, from people that we respect, from people that we look up to. We demand to be told the truth. We don't want to just sit there and be kept told a fairy tale story all the way down the line. We want some truth out of it. We want some potatoes and bread out of it, you know?
I get to meet some of the most incredible people doing what I do, and I really mean that. And one time I gave a talk at a Baptist church, and as I was packing my books from the car to the thing, a man came across the parking lot. I says, well, we have ourselves a Nigerian Muslim here. And I came over, and he was right, but not right. And he said, could I come in? I said, sure, you can come in. And it turned out that he was Nigerian, and he used to be a Muslim, and he is an apostate from Islam and is now a minister, not a minister, but he is now a Christian. And he stood up and he told the group when the talk was over, he says, I've come to here to talk to you about Islam. You Christians don't know much about Islam, but you've met some nice Muslims, and so you say Islam is nice. He says, but I tell you, as Islam becomes strong, you will meet another kind of Muslim, and they will not be nice, and they will have their Sharia. Then he says, now I want to talk to you about your Christianity. He says, in America, Christianity has been made something you do for an hour on Sunday. You want to feel good while you're doing that, and you want it to make you feel good the rest of the week. He says, I tell you, this is not Christianity. And the people in the church and the minister was there, too, just sort of sat there stunned. And then they applauded because they realized he was telling the truth. He says, you want it to be a happy club on Sunday morning. This is not Christianity, I tell you. And I must say, the Christians that I meet from the persecuted lands are another type of Christian.
Yeah.
By the way, when he got through, a man stood up and said, I want to speak as well. I said, I've greatly abbreviated what he said. I said, you're going to follow that? He says, yes, I am. He says, I know this man. He is from the Royal House of Nigeria, and he has had 3 assassination attempts on him. So that is what a man talks like who's nearly been murdered because of the church. He talks like that.
We've got a few minutes left. I'm going to try to get a couple other callers on. Hello, can you hear me? Okay, guess not. Let's try here. Hello?
Hey, Bob. Great to
hey,
you, Bob. Dave.
Hello?
How's it going over there? Hello?
Okay. Who am I talking to?
Can you hear me? It's Barbara.
Oh, hey, how
Barbara
are you?
Barbara from Women Patriots. Catch us tomorrow night at 8. 8 to 10 Central Time right here on conservativenationradio.org. It's going to be an open mic night. We don't know what's going on, but I'm sure something will happen in the news that we'll talk about.
Oh, that's fantastic, Barbara. Can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm still kind of on vacation. I was just getting some pictures. So, yep, that's what we got going on for tomorrow night. So catch us. You've had a great show. I've been listening.
Well, thank you.
Great show going on.
been fantastic, Dave. This is a great show, man. Great guests. I mean, just I'm floored, man. And I'm wanting to push a button, man, and I'm like, oh, Dave's already got it. So you already got this stuff down pat. I don't need to help you.
I don't know about that, but you're doing great, and I'll talk to you guys soon. Hope you'll listen tomorrow. All right, good night, guys.
Take care, Barb. Women Patriots, and your show is what? You changed your time a little bit, so is it 7 to 9?
Yes, I'm sorry. It's 7 to 9 Central Time.
Okay,
thank
you. 8
to 10 Eastern. All right.
Thank you so much, Don.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
All right, bye.
Bye. Bill, you still with us?
I'm still here.
Any upcoming events you want to talk about?
No, not really. Matter of fact, my wife was just saying to me that, this is interesting. It's, we're having success. I haven't had as many talks this year is the reason I'm saying what I'm saying. But now my marketing plan is very simple. I never solicit business, but I don't refuse a call. I mean, my business is like what we had with you. I mean, you call me up, I say, sure, I'll do it. But no, I don't have anything. I have some long-range projects I'm working on. I have now made 4 attempts to start off doing a set of 12 videos. I'm going to do a complete box set on political Islam. So that's one project I'm working on. I do have a project which I'm finishing up on, but it's a very private one called Sniping Dhimmis. Everyone who stands up and supports Islam in public, I write them 2 letters. And the first letter deals with the facts of what they said and how it shows that they don't know anything about Islam. And I invite them to discuss Islam with me. And then when they don't get back to me, and occasionally one will, 1 out of 60 exactly at this point, I then send them a second letter which says, you know, I find that your talk supports the oppressors, Islam, and does not recognize the suffering of the victims. And your higher moral position would be if you supported the victims and opposed the oppressor, Islam. But that's a small private project. I have an enemies list. I realize that there's no more than 200 people in Davidson County who actively support Islam in public. And so I've made it my goal to write every one of them a letter when they pop up in public. So I call it Sniping Dhimmis. I think I'm going to write a newsletter on that because it's the kind of thing where what we want to do in some cases, Dave, is we don't need to convert the people to where they're anti-Islam, but we do need to make them so they're neutralized. So let's say you're a Methodist.
Playing cards. When I was over in Iraq, they gave all the troops playing cards of like the top 52 Iraqis, you know, Hussein on down, you know, Kim Kalali. So that's what we need is playing cards of all the top Islamists in Tennessee so everybody knows who they are, where they live, and what they do.
Well, what I'm doing is I'm writing them all a letter one at a time. And the idea, like I say, is to neutralize them because what I want to do is, let's say that you're a Methodist minister and you go to these Family of Abraham events and you get a couple of my letters and you realize, he's got some points. He doesn't need to speak against Islam. It's just that the next time the Family of Abraham meets, he needs to go, you know, I'm not going to be able to make it. I call that neutralizing. So we need to create an enemies list, our own local enemies list, and I think we need to start working on them one at a time.
I like that. Hey, Bill, I appreciate you coming on. Hey, Bean, thanks for all the help. I'm sure Duke is somewhere cussing me, but we'll talk about that later. thanks for everybody.
No.
Appreciate everything. We're just about out of time. Bean, you have anything before we go? Kurt?
No, great job, Dave. Great job. I'll tune in every week.
Good show, Dave. Thanks, Dr. Warner.
Okay, and if you want to get more of Dr. Warner, politicalislam.com. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Politicalislam.com.
Hey, appreciate you.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
Good night. Hey, real quick, I can get this out before we go. Some of the best sites in Tennessee are TennesseeForPoliticalJustice.com, Daily Roll Call, and BillHislam.com. This is Inside Tennessee, brought to you by Conservative Nation Radio, sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council. Thanks for tuning in.
to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute that you save. Legal tender's never gonna change the number on your days. The highest cost of living's dying, that's one everybody pays. So have it spent the